Well, tonight we continue our series on the existence of God, and we're following, as you know, Stephen Charnock's train of thought in his volumes, The Existence and Attributes of God. Stephen Charnock died in 1680, and the main outline, just a quick review, the main outline that we've had, it can be said different ways, but it's foolish. His main argument, number one, was that it's foolish to deny the universal consent of humanity. That all mankind, no matter what tribe you go to in the history of man, every human tribe and group has been religious, which evidences that there is indeed a supreme being that deserves to be worshipped. The second main argument is that it's folly or foolish to deny what all creatures manifest. And that was kind of the main core of his argument. He spent a lot of time on that. But in their production, every created thing and how they're produced, in their harmony and order, in their preservation, and in their ends. And we're in this section that it's foolish to deny what man's own nature witnesses to him. As Charnock said, we don't necessarily have to go out right now and try and stare at all the creatures. We have ourselves. And our own nature witnesses to the existence of God. And he began pondering the human body and the various organs of the human body. And did, even in his day, refer to the irreducible complexity of things, their systems. They all have to be there. He referred to the human soul mainly as man's mind, as man's understanding, evidencing that God is spirit. And in our soul, which means our spirit, we have our mind, our will, our affections, our conscience. And he was primarily focusing on the understanding, on the mind of man, and how quick it is to think, and its capacity to ponder things immediately 1,000 miles away or halfway around the world, in history, and how it evidences that there's a creator, because it didn't come from the slime. It didn't come from rocks. It didn't come from inanimate matter. It had to come from a mind. Cause is always greater than its effect. Never is an effect greater than its cause, as the Darwinians falsely assume. Well, after the body, after the mind or the understanding in our soul, this is his third, is the conscience of man. The conscience of man. If you'll turn in your Bibles to Romans 2:15, Romans 2:15 says this, that the Gentiles who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. Notice verse 16. In the day when God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. And that plays a role. We tend to think of the conscience only in terms of this faculty of who we are as humans that accuses us of wrong or defends us of right. And that's true. But it's always reminding us there's a judge and a lawgiver. I put on the side over here that both Martin Luther, who died 1546, and John Calvin, died 1564, both Martin Luther and John Calvin believed the law written in men's heart is the Ten Commandments. It's a human faculty within the spirit or heart of us as human beings, the non-physical part, where we have our mind, our will, our affections, and our conscience. Charnock says this, this is a direct quote, "An inward comfort attends good actions, and an inward torment follows bad ones. For there is in every man's conscience fear of punishment and hope of reward. There is, therefore, a sense of some superior judge which has the power both of rewarding and punishing." Unquote. I'll read that again. "An inward comfort attends good actions, and an inward torment follows bad ones. For there is in every man's conscience fear of punishment and hope of reward. There is, therefore, a sense of some superior judge which has the power both of rewarding and punishing." And this is how our own conscience then is witnessing to the very existence of God. He's our creator and our judge. Charnock also said this, as a quote, "If man were his supreme rule, what need he fear punishment? Since no man would inflict evil or torment on himself." Unquote. I'll read that again. If man were his supreme rule, what does he mean by that? If we were a law unto ourselves, another word for that is autonomous. Autonomous. A self-law. That no one had authority over us. We're a law unto ourselves. And you'll typically find among the pagan philosophers, that's their goal. That's what they seek. That was the very temptation of Satan to Eve at the very beginning. You shall be as gods. A law unto yourself. Meaning absolute freedom. Always and everywhere to do whatever you please. And it's always right. But that's God. Only God. Psalm 115:3. He does whatever he pleases. Always and everywhere. Why? Because he is a law unto himself. Only he. And whatever he does is right. Because he is the absolute standard of rectitude, of righteousness. It's the song of the pagans. They're doing it their way. It goes back to that. Now think with me now. Of the pagans, they typically have the view that we are individuals in a state of nature, and that's who we are in this world. And society is a purely human construct, civil society, that we have contracted together. It's a social contract theory of government, that we have just contracted together. Because we know in a state of nature, it's every man for himself, every woman for herself. Dog eat dog. I'm a law unto myself. You're a law unto yourself. We're all doing what we please, but there's great conflict. And therefore, we voluntarily join civil society and we form our own rules and limit ourselves just a bit. It's a social construct. We're limiting our freedom under that pagan view. But who we are is by nature purely and solely an individual, absolutely free to do whatever we please. And then they view law then solely in the negative of what restricts liberty. A negative view of law. That is not the Christian worldview. The Christian worldview is God created us in his image, male and female, that we are by nature social creatures, not just individuals. We're both individuals and social. And that law is actually where true liberty is found, right? It's a positive view of freedom. This is where Charnock's interacting with that, though, okay? With that false view that we're autonomous, that we're a law unto ourselves. They say, you're going to find people that think that way, right? We're in a society all over that Pastor Ron sang that song of the pagans, I did it my way. We have people all over that think they're autonomous. How dare you tell me what to do or anyone tell me what to do? Well, this is what Charnock says. If man were his supreme rule, if it were really true that you were a law unto yourself, no supreme being over you at all, no one, what need he fear punishment? Why would you ever fear punishment? You wouldn't. Since no man would inflict evil or torment on himself. I'm a law unto myself. And really, we have many principles in Scripture that describe this idea that we do love ourselves. There is a proper self-love. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is. Leviticus 19:18. Right? Love your neighbor as yourself. The golden rule, Matthew 7:12. Treat others the way you wish to be treated. That's as well. Jesus quoted the second great commandment, Matthew 22:39. Love your neighbor as yourself. End of Ephesians 5, Ephesians 5:29. Apostle Paul describing marriage. No man hates himself. This is the description, the two shall become one in marriage, husband and wife. The two shall become one. So the husband is to love his wife as his own body. No man hates himself. So he ought to love his wife just as his own body. No man hates himself. So use the same care for your wife. Show it. It's agape love, commitment. Show it. Sacrificial love, right? But no man hates himself. No man would inflict evil or torment on himself. That's the basic fundamental principle, okay? Now, men in extreme wickedness, given over to their own lusts and depraved minds, may be sadomasochists. Well, that's some extreme case of judgment from God, okay? The general rule is that no man would inflict evil or torment on himself. So the only reason that we would fear punishment is because there is a superior judge that's over us who has the power both of rewarding and punishing. Now let me just say, and I've said this in America and Western civilization class, since the rise of modern psychology in the late 1800s into the early 1900s, their main goal in modern psychology is to try and rationalize away guilt. To have a guilt-free world. Sigmund Freud was an atheist, if you remember. He said, so he didn't believe in the existence of God. He said, God did not create man. Man created God. It's just an idea in man's mind, in other words, is what Sigmund Freud said. So then his psychological approach to people who come in with guilt, that it's tormenting them for actions and things they've done and said, was to try and get them to realize that they shouldn't feel that way. That since he was an atheist, he wanted to argue there is no supreme judge. What are you worrying about? What are you fearful of? A What's fascinating is I went back and just for fun this week too and just kind of glanced through a couple books I have in my library that I've read in the past. J. Buczeszewski, The Revenge of Conscience. He had been an academic nihilist. The nihilist says all of life is meaningless. He was academic like C.S. Lewis. But he eventually came to, he's a Roman Catholic, is what he came to. But his mind is a lot like C.S. Lewis's. And he says in there, it's so uncanny how prisoners have a tendency to confess wrongdoing when they're sitting in prison somewhere. We have this innate desire to confess guilt. And he says the conscience is like a loaded spring. Think of the springs on the, some people have, some of the cars have the, especially on the trucks, have the coiled springs. Heavy duty, right? Well, you try and push down on that, right? And it's the idea that no matter where you're pushing, you can hold it down, suppress it for a while. This is Romans 1:18. They hold down or suppress the truth and unrighteousness. With their consciences telling them, you're guilty, you deserve punishment, you're a wicked person. And they're being tormented, and they're holding it down, saying, no, I'm not, I'm okay, there's no judge. I shouldn't have these guilty feelings. But guess what? It's a loaded spring. It always springs back. So Shinnock, what he does is he wants us to consider several things under this heading of the conscience. That is evidence for the existence of God. So this is kind of his introduction in this section, but there's several. We're not going to get through all of them tonight. But he says, consider there is a law in the minds of men. We have to consider this. Romans 2:15 that we read says, the Gentiles show the work of the law written in their hearts. Those who have never had the Holy Scriptures. Right? You read through Romans, and what's Paul's desire is, his letter to the Romans is to go up and visit Rome on the way to what? Spain. And go take the gospel where it's never been before, right? Well, what's he saying is the Gentiles who have never had anything about the Holy Scriptures know nothing about Mount Sinai and the law of Moses. He says, you know, it's fascinating. They show the work of the law written in their hearts who do not have the law. They don't have the Holy Scriptures. That's the beginning of Romans 2:14. In a sense, then, he's saying they show the work. Now, that's key there, the work. In other words, they all show the pattern in some warped, twisted form. They show the pattern, though. In other words, for the most part, they say, yeah, you should tell the truth. But it's always in a warped form. Certain lying's okay. Yeah, you ought not to murder, but, you know, these pregnancies are a nuisance for the sexual revolution. We need abortion. They warp it. But the main structure is there. Right? They had that big thing in the news just recently of that immigrant from Venezuela that murdered that poor young lady down in Georgia. Even the pagans say murder is wrong. He ought to get capital punishment. Looks like the Soros-backed DA didn't put that on the table. Looks like life in prison. But nonetheless, it's still saying that murder is wrong, right? It's still saying it's wrong. Those same people that say abortion's okay. So it's in a warped, twisted form. I brought it up before that, it's been said even the cannibalistic societies, when we've studied the tribes that were cannibalistic, where they eat other human beings, kill them and eat them, Well, they don't kill and eat their own. So even there, they have limits. We're not going to murder our own, but we'll murder others and eat them. They show the work of the law written in their hearts. It's displayed in human laws of civil societies, but in a warped form. One professor I had in graduate school, Dr. Kikasola, he had gotten his MDiv degree from Westminster Theological Seminary and studied under John Murray, but I just remember it vividly. I took a class in political philosophy with him, and he, going through Romans 1:18 on the holding down or suppressing, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold down or suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And he said, literally, that can be translated warped. They twist it. And it's always stuck with me. We say that about wicked people. They're twisted. Well, what is it they twisted? A standard. A law. Right? That's what it presupposes when you say that. You have to twist something. Well, what is it? The law of God. 2 Peter 3:16. Distort the truth and unrighteousness. The untaught and unstable distort to their own destruction. I put one example by the Pharisees and scribes, Matthew 15:3-6, with their Corban law, right? Where they come up with their own human traditions to say, I'm not, you know, they have a duty before God, a law to honor your father and mother, right? Instead of following the Ten Commandments, what do? They say, oh, no, I've committed my property as a gift to God. And therefore, I can't give it to my parents. Yeah, can't take care of them. Tough luck. Yeah. They warped it. They twisted it. They're acknowledging, yeah, you ought to honor your father and mother, but not here, you know, for their love of money. Let me say a bit on this before I continue. Another book I went back and glanced through this last week, The Vanishing Conscience. We have it in the library here, in the church library, The Vanishing Conscience by John MacArthur. He wrote it in 1994. I was 22 going on 23 years old at that time. It's a very good book. If you get a chance, read it. It's very good. Think of the title a minute. The Vanishing Conscience. Where we're living in a society right now where it's trying to be a guilt-free world. Following modern psychology. And one of the texts he goes through in that book is Romans 1, where individuals hold down or suppress the truth and unrighteousness. They warp it. The wrath of God revealed from heaven, present ongoing tense, is when we see people given over first to uncleanness, Romans 1:24, and then given over to their lusts, Romans 1:26. And then given over to a depraved mind. Romans 1:28. And he says it's a progression downward from uncleanness to evil lusts to a depraved mind, where your mind is actually rationalizing and promoting evil and approving of evil and wanting others to approve evil. That's Romans 1:32 where it ends. Even though they know that those who do these such things are deserving of death, yet they give approval. And their mind is behind it, rationalizing it. And that's what they're doing right now all over in our society. He says in that book for the last 40, 50 years, he's before the 1960s Cultural Revolution of the downgrade. Francis Schaeffer also kind of goes back to the 1930s and early 1900s. That's where you say, how do you get to people if we have a conscience that accuses us of wrong, defends us when we do right? How do you get a group of people in a society like Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20, that call what is evil good, and what is good, evil. Right? When our conscience is so seared. This argument from conscience is still there nonetheless, even though our society is wicked. We're a long way on the downgrade from uncleanness to lust all the way to a depraved mind. And yet there's still this pattern that's there, that's patterned after the Ten Commandments. Pagans still want to honor their parents in some way, a warped way, but some way. Want to in some way say that murder is wrong. What Charnock says is this. He says certain laws, this is laws of civil societies, certain laws, quote, are common in all countries. That there's certain due process that, you know, I have one book in my library dealing with comparative law with different countries of Europe and different countries around the world, with the U.S. and, you know, this idea of wanting somewhat of a due process, that if you're accused of wrongdoing before punishment takes place, that there's some evidence gathering and proof required. C.S. Lewis once noted, he said, okay, in England, you drive on the left side of a two-lane road, and we drive on the right side of a two-lane road in America. But he said the underlying principle is the same. Order. You got to pick one or the other, right? You got to pick one or the other. Can't have chaos, we'll have head-on collisions. Right? So the underlying moral principle is the same. Well, their laws are common in all countries to a certain extent. The more a society is down on the downgrade, the more it's being judged by God, the less true that is. You could say they're more common in wickedness. But there's still a structure. There's still a structure. The way Paul puts it is the Gentiles, quote, by nature do the things in the law. Romans 2:14, the Gentiles by nature do the things in the law. You know, you can go back and study in their ancient Greece law and their legal system of the various Greek city-states, the Roman Republic. They had, I remember looking back at some of them, where you could be punished for moving somebody's property boundary, right? It's in the Mosaic Law. But if I recall, it was the ancient Greeks. And then they'd have someone punished for it, even with the death penalty, I think it was. And the reason they'd be given as a sacrifice to one of the Greek gods. So it's in a warped, twisted form. And yet there's this idea, don't be messing with people's boundaries on their property. There's this idea that property rights are somewhat sacred. Thou shalt not steal. It's kind of written on human hearts. They show the work of the law written in the human hearts, but it's within this warped form of paganism. So when they punish somebody, we're going to punish you as a sacrifice to the god. It's kind of in a warped form. But by nature, this is where I'd underline this word, by nature they do the things in the law, that man's essence or nature is fixed. The laws of the Ten Commandments are fixed. They're not changing. They're not evolving, are they? And this framework of a biblical view of a human being having a conscience is the belief that human nature is fixed. We have an essence. We're not constantly in change. Another way of saying it is we're a human being, where the other person would say you're only becoming. You're only changing. Well, we're both a human being and becoming. I've lost some hair. I got more gray in my beard. I'm changing over the years, right? under the curse of sin, I'm aging, was as a creature we change. Only God is unchanging because only God is eternal. Those go together, remember. But we have a nature. We're a human being. And that has been attacked by Hegel and others for the last 200 years, heavy, to deny that we have an essence, a human being, that we're a human being. To them, all we are is evolving change. Michelle Obama, she had written a book a few years ago titled Becoming. Tells you about everything. But as Christians, we believe in human nature. And really, when you begin to think that there's this structure you see, when you begin to analyze and compare legal systems around the world and ethical systems around the world, there's a core structure among human beings. And that shows then that there's a law written in the human heart that's the same for all of us. We have a nature. Doesn't matter whether we're living in our present time or in the 1600s or in the 1200s or in the 200s or in the 1000 BC. It does not matter when we live, where we live in the world. Doesn't matter if you're from the jungle in Burma. There's still this sense that certain things are right and certain things are wrong, and it tends to follow the structure of the Ten Commandments. And that's why every tribe is religious. They know they ought to worship something which the first few commandments are dealing with. Charnock says this, another quote from Charnock, man in the first instant of the use of reason, so think of human development, okay, right, from a baby to a child, adolescent, well, when you first develop reason, man in the first instant of the use of reason begins to think logical and rational, finds natural principles within himself. Directing and choosing them, he finds a distinction between good and evil. How could this be if there were not some rule in him to try and distinguish good and evil? Don't we find that among children? Once they begin to think rationally, and think? What do? When they think someone wronged them? Get the judge in the household. Mom, he did this. Dad, he did this, right? You know what I'm talking about, right? This is this idea that the human being, in the first instance of the use of reason, finds natural principles within himself, directing and choosing them. He finds a distinction between good and evil. Joey took my toy. What? Thou shalt not steal. How could this be if there were not some rule in him to try and distinguish good and evil? It evidences that we have a nature, we're a human being, and God wrote his laws on our heart. And let me say this as well. I got to say this as well in this topic on the vanishing conscience, or that it's like a loaded spring. Okay? We may go through periods of time, and a human being can go through periods of time where it's like 1 Timothy 4:2, it's seared. It's with a hot branding iron, where it's just, as John MacArthur would say in his book, The Vanishing Conscience, it's like mud on the windshield. We're not seeing the curbs very good. That's what sin does. So it's a human faculty accusing us of wrong, defending us of right according to the highest standard of right and wrong. We know knowledge is a prerequisite for the conscience to work right. We have to have true knowledge of what's right and wrong. And God wrote his laws in our heart. We can't claim ignorance. That's the point of all of this. There is no excuse. This is another way which God's revealing himself to us, every one of us, within our own being and nature. That he's the lawgiver, he's our creator, he has authority over us, and he is our judge, with both the power of rewarding and the power of punishing. But there's this, there's a sense in which human beings cannot erase the fact that they're a human being. Human beings cannot erase the fact that they're a human being. They can try and warp and twist and suppress their conscience, but they can never erase it. That's Dr. Greg Bahnsen in his book, Always Ready. I think we've got that in the library here as well. Excellent book. If you ever get a chance, read it. Always Ready. This is the point of contact you and I have with every pagan, every unbeliever. They have a conscience, and they cannot erase it. And this is why Sproul would always talk to somebody who was not a believer, not a Christian, and say, well, what do you do with your guilt? You have a conscience. It accuses you of wrong. Guilt is this obligation to be punished. You know it. You have a sense of it. So what do you do with your guilt? Do you keep going to the psychiatrist week after week, after month, year after year, trying to somehow persuade you that there's no judge over the heaven and earth? What do you do with your guilt? This is another angle to take it. Sin can be defined different ways, right? We know sin can be defined different ways in Scripture. Not living for the glory of God, Romans 3:23. Israelites in the wilderness, what's sin? Rebellion against God's authority. They rebelled in the wilderness. Right, lots of ways to take sin, but one of the ways that's real clear is sin is lawlessness. 1 John 3:4. Sin is lawlessness, right? Disobeying God's law. Without a law in man, he could not sin. This is where Paul kind of discusses that briefly in Romans 5:13 to say, you know, before Moses gave the law, God gave the law through Moses, right? Mount Sinai. But yet there was still sin. How could that be? Because there was law. And it's written in human hearts. Law did exist before Moses gave it. The Ten Commandments flow from who God is. This is where you can go study the creation ordinances. We're binding on Adam and Eve at the very beginning in John Murray's book, Principles of Conduct. So if somebody was out in the jungle somewhere and never had the Bible, never had the Holy Scripture, on what grounds would you say they're a sinner? If you need a law first. If it takes law to exist, being promulgated to them. Promulgation of law, this is the idea. We have this in our history of Western civilization, that for us to be responsible for a law, it needs to be promulgated. It needs to be displayed. Right? You have the speeding sign displayed. Okay? So they can't just leave everything blank, and then we have no idea when the speed limit's 30, 35, 45, 55, 70, whatever, and we just drive around. No, they have to promulgate it and display it and show us and give us knowledge of it before we're responsible for it. To obey it or disobey it, you see? Right? It has to be given to us, and we have to have knowledge of it first. So where did God give the law to people who never had the Bible? It's written in human hearts, right? That's the idea. It's written in human hearts. God wrote His law, the Ten Commandments, in human hearts. He just happened to then write the Ten Commandments on stones for humans at Mount Sinai. But again, remember, when we say that the Ten Commandments are written in human hearts, it does not include the preface, the redemptive preface. I am the Lord your God that brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. I redeemed you. That's the preface for Israel. The preface to the Ten Commandments is not the Ten Commandments. That's So the Ten Commandments itself is not redemptive. It's just what ought to be and what ought not to be, period. Remember that, right? It's critical. This is why we know every single human being on the planet is a sinner. Their own conscience bears witness. They have a law. It's written in human hearts. Sin is lawlessness. Without an objective, absolute standard, Charnock says that, quote, the worst act would be as commendable as the best, unquote. Commendable being praiseworthy. That without an objective absolute standard, if there's no absolute standard, Charnock says that the worst act would be as commendable and praiseworthy as the best. If you don't have a standard, if there is no standard for judging right and wrong, the worst is just as praiseable as the best. To them, everything's evolving. That's where they're taking polls, right? This is where, really, since after Hegel, that humans just, our thinking is conditioned by the culture we live in. And as culture evolves and changes, your thinking evolves and changes about what's right and wrong. All they have is change, becoming. It's all they have. For the pagans, and that's why they just take a poll. Well, what do the majority of people want? And this is where you have to look at them and say, well, what if the majority of people, just like in the Weimar Republic, do choose to exterminate the Jews or some other ethnic group? Just because the majority of people in the mob say, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him, does that mean it's right? No. It doesn't. Because there's a standard that's outside of us, an absolute objective standard that's outside of our subjective minds. C.S. Lewis noted that to say something is better or worse than something else requires an objective standard different from them and outside them to judge them. So you're looking at two things and you're saying, well, what's better and what's worse? Well, you need a standard outside of them and different from them to say what's better or worse. So I was sitting here, I was writing the notes on the board, and I thought, well, can I give an illustration of this? I thought about sports. Okay, now think about this with me. Think. Two different sports. You could pick different ones, but I thought, how about golf as compared to soccer? Huh? In golf, a lower score is better. But in soccer, a higher score is better. Why? It's because a different standard applies to golf than to soccer. It's the objective standard that's outside of what's going on in the play that determines what's better or worse. And that's the same for us as human beings. Once your mind is saying, well, this is a better public policy than that. You say, well, that assumes a standard. What is that standard? Each sport has an objective standard or rule to judge better or worse that determines whether something's better or worse. If you don't have an objective standard to say whether something is better or worse, it doesn't matter what you score. Whether your golf ball goes 20 times into the pond or not, if you don't have an objective standard, anything goes. Right? Then in the soccer game, the one who scored zero says, I won. And the other one, team that scored four goals, says, no, we didn't. You're like, well, which is it? Which is better? Which is worse? It's the standard that determines it. But our conscience is accusing us of wrong or defending us when we do right. Okay, that's this human faculty within us. And it tells us then Some actions are bad, some actions are good. Some things are better than others. You get done, you say, you know, I could have done better than that, the way I said that or explained it or whatever. Well, it's according to some standard we have. Written in our hearts about what's right and wrong. God provides the objective standard. Charnock, this is a direct quote from him, "I find myself naturally obliged to do this thing and avoid that. I have, therefore, a superior that does oblige me." Unquote. Read it again. "I find myself naturally obliged to do this thing and avoid that. I have, therefore, a superior that does oblige me." Do you feel that prick of conscience when somebody asks you something that happened and you're thinking in your mind, it's going to be a little embarrassing if I say the truth? But you feel obligated not to lie? These obligations that are put on us, these duties that are put on us, are from a superior, and that's God. In ethics, you know, they refer to it as deontological ethics, meaning duty-based. Christianity is a deontological-based ethical system. It's duty-based. God gives us duties, and they're laid out in His laws that are written on our hearts. And we are obligated to obey Him. He has the absolute authority over us and has given the standard to us. So think in your mind, every time your conscience pricks you, it's evidencing the existence of God. Here's another one. He says, "Consider that fears arise from transgressing this law of nature." Now, notice he used the phrase law of nature. That's what the founders used, the Christian founders, in the Declaration of Independence, in the opening paragraph. Referred to the laws of nature and nature's God, whom they appealed to. The law of nature. But consider the fears arising from transgressing this law of nature, because it's in the nature of who we are as a human being. This is me paraphrasing what he wrote. "Some men cannot stand their guilt on their deathbed and cry out when their fear overwhelms them. Some men cannot stand their guilt on their deathbed and they cry out when their fear overwhelms them." Proverbs 1:27. Proverbs 1:27. "When your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you." Our conscience reminds us of things we've done wrong. You know, J. Buczyszewski said, "Why is it that so many prisoners confess wrongdoing in the jail cell?" The terror, their guilt is overwhelming them, and they have this need to confess to try and get it off their chest. I had some men, when I was in forestry, I remember in my early and mid-20s, some men I came across in forestry were older, and just out of the blue, here and there in conversations, they just start confessing to me wicked things they'd done when they were young. It's fascinating. Things that I wouldn't repeat and haven't repeated to people. Wicked. the guilt overwhelms them, and they think back, and it haunts them. This is, again, where Sproul looks at people who are unbelievers, not Christians, says, well, what do you do with your guilt? For us, as Christians, we know Christ nailed it to the cross for us. I think there was, I think in one of the biographies of John Wayne, you know, I enjoy Westerns, Ward Bond, I think it was when Ward Bond died, John Wayne went to his deathbed, and Ward Bond was pretty drunk at the time. How do you deal with that guilt, see? He's drowning it in alcohol on his deathbed. Charnock wrote this, if men stand in awe of punishment, there is then some superior to whom they are accountable. If there were no God, there were no punishment to fear. Read it again. If men stand in awe of punishment, there is then some superior to whom they are accountable. And if there were no God, there were no punishment to fear. Charnock makes the note that it will even surprise the hypocrites. Isaiah 33:14. Isaiah 33:14. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has seized the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? Fearfulness has seized the hypocrites. He's got several things then to think about how this fear arises from transgressing the laws of nature that God has written on our heart. So he kind of goes with each of these. This operation of producing fear of punishment within us. And we're just going to look at the beginning one here. Okay? But there's more to come on that, Lord willing, next time we meet. But he says this, this operation of conscience has been universal. This operation of conscience has been universal. That the superior that we're accountable to is over all. No exceptions. He says, Pharaoh's conscience even pricked him of wrongdoing. Exodus chapter 9, verse 27. And Pharaoh sent and called for Moses and Aaron and said to him, I have sinned this time. The Lord is righteous, and my people and I are wicked. Adam's conscience accused him of wrongdoing in Genesis chapter 3, verse 10. So he said, I heard your voice, O God, in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself after he ate the forbidden fruit, which Charnock says, quote, was an expectation of the judgment of God. He was afraid. The day you eat of it, you shall surely die. He was afraid of punishment. Conscience was accusing him of wrongdoing. Adam had an expectation of the judgment of God. Charnock says this, quote, every man's conscience testifies that he is unlike what he ought to be according to that law engraven upon his heart. Romans 2:15. Read it again. Every man's conscience testifies that he is unlike what he ought to be, according to that law engraven upon his heart. That's one thing, too, Sproul would say when you're having a discussion with someone about guilt, and they're kind of weaselly about it, kind of, you know, like a slippery fish, whether they're going to really acknowledge it or not. You say, well, are you telling me you're perfect? This is where Sproul would say deep down people know they're not perfect. They are unlike what they ought to be. And people know it because they have a conscience that accuses them of wrongdoing. Now, certainly a conscience can be seared, 1 Timothy 4:2. Seared as with a branding iron for cattle, right? Where it scars the skin, it kind of roughs up the edges, things aren't as crisp and clear on details. That's where John MacArthur says it's like mud thrown on the windshield, you can't see the curbs as good on the road. And people call what is good as evil, and what is evil is good, Isaiah 5:20. But Charnock says deep down in their heart, they know that those who practice such things are worthy of death. Deep down they know it. That's what Romans 1:32 says. Even in our society, where they're all over the place, especially among the within the loony left, deep down they know there's a difference between men and women. They know it. You know, we have reality on our side. Right? This is where we're arguing based on what's right and wrong, based on reality, the way things really are. And that's where men have an XY chromosome and women have XX chromosomes. No matter how much you change the outside appearance, the chromosomes remain the same in the genes. But this is where, in the history of the world, one has to look with what's been really overall common. And that's what Charnock's getting at, is there's periods of time where people are given over, they're under God's judgment, they're given over to uncleanness, lust, and a depraved mind. But the core ethic is always the same. They can never erase the fact that they're human beings. Deep down they know, but this is what gives us contact. That's Dr. Greg Bahnsen, always ready in his book. It gives us contact with every one of them. Deep down they know that they ought not to steal and they ought not to lie. They ought not to murder and hate. Why is that? So our conscience evidences that there's a God. He exists. And we're going to, Lord willing, pick this up the next time we meet. We're going to look at other operations here of the conscience, of how it puts fear in us, torment in us when we've done wrong, and how that operation works. So, Lord willing, that's where we'll pick it up next time we meet.